You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In this crazy mixed-up world of ours, at least one thing's for sure. Millions of people worldwide love Apple products, and especially the iPhone, which is encouraging us to share our experiences with unparalleled frequency. But, asks Wired columnist Brian Chin, at what cost? His new book, Always On, How the iPhone Unlocked the Anything, Anytime, Anywhere Future and Locked Us In, questions what it means to live in a society that is indeed always on. It's published by DiCapo, and I'm very pleased that it brings them to our show today. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
So is Google Apple's only rival for taking over the world?
Right now, Google's strategy is the only effective strategy against Apple right now, and it's because they're trying to be in as many places as possible, whereas Apple is only trying to be on Apple hardware. So it's an effective combative strategy.
Apple's approach is vertical integration?
Vertical integration is the concept of one company being in control of core aspects of their strategic business. So, for example, Apple controls the software and the hardware of the iPhone. They design it and determine what features are on the device.
Well, didn't Microsoft get into trouble for doing something similar?
Microsoft got in trouble in particular with Internet Explorer. They were making the browser free and had some anti-competition issues back in the day. Microsoft was kind of like Google, actually. They were trying to be everywhere. It's horizontal integration where they were making the software and providing it to the hardware partners. And so in that way, they're not really in control of, you know, the whole operation like Apple is with the iPhone or the Macintosh.
So does that make Apple unique?
I don't think it makes Apple unique. We can look at vertical integration going as far back as Henry Ford. Henry Ford would, for example, you know, have his own windshields. And for a while, he bought out all the materials needed to make windshields and created a chokehold on those resources. So it's a very interesting
strategy. And then General
Motors
did the same. They built their own bodies. And they owned all the companies that supplied them.
Yeah. And I also mentioned in my book that Starbucks used to be a more vertically integrated company because they tried very hard to seek out very unique quality beans and were very careful about the roasting equipment that they use. They own their own roasters and train their own employees for 2 years and so forth. So that's another example of vertical integration.
But you say they used to. What happened?
They got a little bit too big, and I think they lost sight of some of those core vertical values. Like, for example, they stopped using hand grinding for, you know, making coffee and dripping coffee. They started using these automatic machines because they had to grow too much and had to serve too many people, and they lost control of the experience. And eventually, their stock tanked and their sales went down because people recognized what was going on.
But also went into the music business and did all sorts of other things.
Yeah, of course.
So let's talk about Apple.
Sure.
Apple was not doing well, and then suddenly it just came out with a whole group of technological advances. Apple software paved the way for the iPhone.
I would say that the iTunes Store was the big precursor to the iPhone and the App Store, because the iTunes Store was this one-click solution for downloading music, which debuted on the iPod, of course. So that was the big first step for Apple. They were establishing an ecosystem where you could easily buy media for a device. And after that, the iPhone came along, and eventually the App Store came along, so you could download applications with the tap of a button.
How did Steve Jobs get the record companies to allow Apple to sell their music on iTunes?
It was actually a pretty sly negotiation move with iTunes. He basically said, so, you know, the Macintosh only has such a small market share, about 9 to 10% market share in the PCs, in the PC market, and said, you know, let's try this out. You know, iTunes is only on the Mac, and it's going to be like an experiment for you. And eventually, he got them to agree to do this, and he rolled out iTunes on Windows. So then suddenly, everybody had access to iTunes, and the iTunes Store was an extremely popular destination for downloading digital music.
So he kind of screwed them.
I would think that a lot of them feel that way, but at the same time, they're benefiting from a lot of sales of digital music. So,
well, the big problem for them is that record stores are closing, and something had to be done.
Yeah, and I think it takes that sort of trickery from a guy like Steve Jobs. I mean, Steve Jobs also did something similar with AT&T and the iPhone. He made AT&T agree to service the iPhone without actually looking at it, so that Apple could have, like I said, vertical control over the hardware and the software. And I don't know how he made them do that, but that's what really blew up the wireless industry, because before, the carriers determined what features were on software for phones.
But that was both that was a mixed deal for AT&T. It had exclusive use of the iPhone for a long time. But at the same time, it couldn't really handle the technology.
Yeah, I think that was part of what made them agree to service the phone, by having the exclusivity agreement for about 3 years or so. And yeah, it turned out that the iPhone was just so popular that they did have a lot of issues servicing the phone, because so many people were hogging the network bandwidth. And of course, you know, here in New York and also in San Francisco, people were complaining like crazy. They couldn't get a signal anywhere, which is really what I think diminished their reputation a lot in the past few years because of the iPhone. But at the same time, it's a mixed blessing.
Well, Verizon waited it out and saw what problems AT&T had. And then they wound up getting it's not an exclusive deal, but they are the only other company that can use the iPhone.
Yeah, true. And I think they were waiting for the exclusivity agreement to end. But I think we should expect the rest of the carriers, including T-Mobile, since AT&T now owns T-Mobile, and
Sprint.
And Sprint, to get the iPhone pretty soon, since that exclusivity agreement, AT&T, is over.
But Google tried a different approach with its Android technology.
Sure, with the Android technology, Google made the operating system available to anybody agreeing to support it. So like, say, Motorola or LG, any phone maker who wanted the operating system could just take it and put it on their phone, and it would be up to the carriers to determine whether or not they wanted to service those phones.
Now, you write about the positives and the negatives of smartphones in this book.
Yeah.
Is Google's Android system any less dangerous in your eyes?
Danger as in, and what would you mean by dangerous?
Well, we'll get into the whole business about anything, anywhere, anytime, for example, which is at the center of the title of your book.
Sure. Well, with Google, I think it's kind of becoming the same in a way, because they just recently announced they're acquiring Motorola. And you can see what's happening here, because Google's strategy of partnering with just about anybody created a lot of issues for the Android platform. Like, say, for example, if I buy an Android phone today, it's not going to be guaranteed that the next Android phone I buy is going to have the same software and I'll be able to run the same applications, because all the different manufacturers are running different versions of the software. So by buying Motorola, they're going to be able to just have a perfect Google phone and issue the software updates whenever they want, just like Apple does with the iPhone. So they're taking a vertical approach, which is pretty interesting.
But at the same time, they're telling people that they're not going to prevent everybody else from using the technology.
Yeah, and
having it both ways?
That's something they say, but I don't think that's going to really pan out. I think they're going to really tick off their partners who have been making Android phones for a long time, because, of course, you know, Google is going to have the best Android phone, so they're a competitor with their partners, and that's something that historically hasn't really worked out.
My guest is Brian X. Chen, who currently writes for Wired.com, where his regular column on Apple is followed by millions of readers. He's written a book called Always On, How the iPhone Unlocked the Anything, Anytime, Anywhere Future and Locked Us In. It's published by DeCapo. So let's talk about anything, anywhere, anytime. What do you mean by that?
So when I say anything, anytime, anywhere, I mean that potentially we have a device that is capable of doing anything, and we have access to basically anything because of the App Store. So with the App Store, it was a really significant revolution, because before the App Store, there wasn't a very cohesive platform to just download software and for software makers to make money very easily, that is, independent software makers. And so, you know, on my iPhone, I can just like tap a button and suddenly I'm expanding the functionality of my phone and I'm capable of doing something. Like, I have some examples in the book of a man in Haiti. He survived an earthquake, he survived the Haiti earthquake because he was able to use a first aid application that he downloaded on his iPhone and learn how to bandage his wound. And he did that while he waited for rescuers to come get him. And those are some really interesting examples, or this is one interesting example of what you could potentially do with an iPhone. So I take this idea of anything, anytime, anywhere, and I ask the question, how does this reshape the way that we do business, or how does it change our culture? How does it change the way that people treat medicine or embrace education or enforce policing?
Well, some of these things really seem positive, like the story you tell, or some of the more benign things that you can do with an iPhone or a smartphone, like just get music, the music you like, free. You can find the local restaurant, the local laundromat, all of those things. But Gary Steingart wrote a novel recently in which he suggested that this is going to lead us to things like you walk into a bar and everybody knows how much money you make, how sexually attractive people find you, and everything else. And that may not be such a positive development, and it doesn't seem all that shocking, even though it is a work of fiction.
I think that is a very bold prediction. It's also it's plausible, like you say, at the same time. But I think right now, one issue that he's touching on is the issue of privacy. And yes, we definitely have issues of privacy, which is a big wrinkle that I highlight in one chapter of the book, because these phones have increasingly powerful sensors that are like they can detect where we are. They can detect very precise movements. And there are also hundreds of thousands of software makers living on these platforms from Apple and Google, and they're capable of just being able to just peek in if they wanted to without really getting caught. So in the book, you know, I push for or I argue for some amendments to some laws or some new laws to hopefully regulate these companies who make this software. There was an example of a software maker that did violate privacy by spying on children's IM conversations when they were actually providing a parental control software. So, you know, these are people who say they're offering us something, but they could be doing something behind the scenes we're not aware of.
It also allows tabloid journalists in England and maybe elsewhere to listen into our voicemail.
Yeah, I mean, that's
they figure out how to ping. Is it pinging people? And then they would just hack into their telephone.
Are you talking about the whole Murdoch scandal right now? Yeah, I mean,
isn't that part of this?
Yeah, I mean,
that wouldn't have been possible in the old days with a landline.
That's a good point. That's another cautionary tale about digital privacy in the connected age. We need some new regulations around privacy, especially on these devices that are capable of following our movements and just. There's so much information on these devices, more than we are probably remembering about ourselves. These phones have so much information about us.
We'll take a little break and come back with some of those laws that you propose and also talk about the explosion of apps, which you call something of a digital gold rush. Find out what's happening these days. The book is Always On: How the iPhone Unlocked the Anything, Anytime, Anywhere Future and Locked Us In. It's published by DeCapo. We'll be back with Brian X. Chen right after this. We're back with Bruce X. Chen, who is who writes for Wired.com, where he has a regular column, which he writes about Apple. That's an incredible specialty there, and he has millions of readers, and now he's written a book he hopes will also have millions of readers called Always On: How the iPhone Unlocked the Anything, Anytime, Anywhere Future and Locked Us In. It is published by DeCapo. I wonder whether you're hoping that this is, or is this available on an e-book?
Oh, of course, yeah. It's available on Amazon, hardcover, of course, Kindle, of course, iBooks, e-book. It's also available on Audible. I did the narration.
and we hope that Apple doesn't get upset with you.
I think they're going to be okay with it.
You're right that civil law hasn't caught up with many of these new technologies. Where do you see the law needing to be changed the most?
Right now, there's been a lot of controversy around how police officers can search your cell phones. There's actually very few limitations around how they can search cell phones. The cell phone is kind of considered like a closed container. Like, say, for example, you're pulled over for running a stop sign, which is an arrestable offense if a police officer determines so, and you have a pack of cigarettes on you. If he wanted to, he could search the pack of cigarettes without a warrant. The iPhone is the same way. It's considered a closed container. So he could ask you, you know, he could say that you look suspicious. Let me see your iPhone and search everything, like your emails, your photos, your text messages, and so forth. And there's just so much information here where it's almost redundant. It's almost unnecessary. They shouldn't have access to that much information. So some law professors have talked about, you know, ideas of imposing limitations on cell phone searches, like saying having another number of steps for a police officer, like saying you can only search with three steps. You can open the email, you can launch the browser and look at the most recent history, for example, and that's all you can do. You know, stop after that. So I think these are some interesting ideas that people are proposing, and hopefully we'll see some changes in this area soon.
Well, have we seen many of these phishing expeditions?
I've heard recently that there were police officers searching cell phones at DUI checkpoints to see if people were talking about, you know, like, oh, let's go meet up and drink, you know, like an hour ago. But these are all these are pretty rare episodes that I've heard about in the news. But it's at the same time, they highlight the potential and also just the possibility of this happening to people, which I think is a concern.
And why do you think this hasn't gotten more national attention?
I think some legislators are actually pushing for new laws and hopefully making something happen pretty soon. I think it's still a pretty unique issue where the technology is still new and people still are not very aware of the problem, which is, you know, part of the purpose of my book is to raise this awareness. But I think also right now, a lot of people who are very enthusiastic about like iPhones and Android phones are also they don't really care that much about privacy. You know, they're all about like saying, oh, I'm on Foursquare. I just ate over here. Like, I'm telling everybody where I am all day. So I think a lot of people are a little bit insensitive to these problems.
You write that your friend Jonathan, and this is one of the hardest names I've ever tried to pronounce in my life.
Jonathan Zarsky.
ZDZIARSKI, who teaches digital forensics classics specifically for the iPhone, is ambivalent about the lack of certain security features on the phone.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, for one thing, it gives him a job. I mean, there are a lot of security holes in the iPhone, which makes it fascinating for him to teach law enforcement how to hack these phones and just get all this information from suspects. Like, he says that the forensics tools he's given to police officers for hacking cell phones has helped them arrest rapists and murderers and so forth. And he can't go into too much detail about that. But so he thinks that's a good thing. You know, it's good evidence against people who have committed serious crimes. At the same time, it's very concerning that these phones have such low security.
And have the courts dealt with them the way you suggest as the equivalent of a closed container?
I think these discussions are just about to start, or they're just starting right now. And the most recent person who's been pushing for new legislation around this has been Al Franken, Senator Al Franken. And he was raising issues because of that recent iPhone location tracking issue, where basically a bug inside the iPhone was storing information about where you've been for the past year. And it turned out it wasn't like precise locations of where you've been, but just triangulations of cell phone towers and Wi-Fi access points that give people a general map of where you've been for the past year.
And who was using them? For what reason?
It turned out that Apple was collecting this information to build a location database. So when you pull out your iPhone and you're trying to locate where you are, it does it faster because first you're pulling from Apple's location database about these, you know, these Wi-Fi access points and these cell phone towers. And so that's providing a service to people, but at the same time, people weren't aware that Apple was doing this, and so because of the lack of disclosure, it was considered an invasion of privacy.
So where does Apple stand on all of this? Are they lobbying Washington against the Franken bill?
No, they've been cooperative. Google, too, was also called forward because they're also doing anonymous collection of, you know, location. And these companies are blazing new trails with new technologies, and of course they're going through some growing pains. Of course, like when you start something, there's always going to be some problems you create. And I think now they're just realizing that there are some problems they create. So they are revising some of their methods and being more clear about their disclosure about what they're doing. I think one big thing that Al Franken definitely wants is privacy policies for the companies that make software for these smartphones. Like, say, you know, I can tell this application maker you can't be pulling somebody's location information if you're not providing location service. You know, that wouldn't be fair.
Most people are concerned about having a private email message and then seeing an ad pop up that relates to what they discussed. We have been reassured that the algorithms are not really reading, or whatever it is, and they're not really reading our messages. They're just simply finding phrases and responding. But it does make you feel a little uneasy.
We take a pretty giant leap of faith, I think, just trusting these really rich companies who, especially Google. Google is a company that makes most of its money trading data about people and advertising, of course. And especially if, you know, like Gmail, like when you type a keyword in Gmail, suddenly you get these advertisements on the side. So we're just trusting them that they're not doing anything like with our emails, and I'm not sure if I'm kind of skeptical about it.
Well, they did promise not to do any harm or any evil.
Oh, you know, that's, I think that's, at this point, it's considered a marketing slogan.
Well, let's talk about marketing for a moment. Apple originally was, it was suggested to Apple not to call themselves Apple because it didn't sound technological enough. Obviously, it was a very good branding concept. But what do you think about some of the other naming conventions Apple has popularized, like iLife, iMac, iTunes? And what does that I stand for?
I think the I at this point is like, it's the idea of software becoming so mainstream that it enters your lifestyle. Before, even thinking of the app is a pretty significant word because it's such a simple word. It's three letters. Back in the day, we didn't call them apps. We called them applications. We called them software. And now that software has entered the mainstream and people are pulling out their smartphones and playing with, Angry Birds at a bar, or like showing each other, oh, look at this cool app I downloaded. Now software is entered the mainstream and people are talking about it very casually. Whereas, you know, if you talked about software at a bar before, you probably wouldn't be at a bar, you know, you'd probably be banned. But it's the idea of like the hardware and software just being at the center of your lifestyle.
And of course now your iPhone can also settle many bar disputes. Just simply Google the subject in question. And
yeah, you could, if you're curious about something, you're arguing about something, you could just go hop on Wikipedia and say, yeah, this happened in 1942 or something, yeah.
Brian X. Chen is my guest. His book, Always On, How the iPhone Unlocked the Anything, Anytime, Anywhere Future and Locked Us In. It's published by DeCapo. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How did the apps develop in the first place? What was Mac Heist?
Mac Heist was a really interesting company because they did this software promotion stunt. So they created videos, they created little puzzles, and like people would play these puzzles and they would unlock like passwords to get free software. And so this is for Macintosh software. This is before the iPhone even existed. And it exemplified just how difficult it was for software makers to sell software, like independent software programmers versus like, you know, big game companies with gigantic marketing budgets. So they would have to go through these hoops to promote software. So this was just an example. So after that, the App Store really demonstrates how effective a model it was. Now I could just go into this store that anybody could just put something into. You could search a keyword, you could find the application, you could download the application, pay for it without really doing anything except for entering your password. And that didn't really exist before on the web. You know, with the web, it's just so chaotic. You have to go through all these different websites. There wasn't a one-click solution. And there are a lot of barriers to actually downloading software. So
did Apple steal Mac Heist?
I don't think,
or the concept.
I don't think Apple stole the concept of Mac Heist, but I think a lot of them recognized that there was an inefficiency in digital distribution and software sales, and it was something that they worked together or they worked toward to solve for many years, and finally nailed with the App Store in 2008.
You've compared the flood of apps several years ago to a digital gold rush. Did some app developers really strike it rich?
Yeah, a lot of my sources that I interview for stories today are still some of the most successful iPhone programmers. And if they get something in the top 25, like top 25 best-selling apps, they could be making upwards of $60,000 to $70,000 a day selling a piece of software. So it's like, okay, that is kind of incredible.
Well, not everybody charges. There are an awful lot of free apps.
Not everybody charges.
They make their money from advertising.
Some people use advertising. Some people use the free application to advertise the paid version of the application, so like freemium. Some people use a free version and sell stuff within the application, like buying like weapons inside a game and so on. So it's really interesting to see what people are doing.
Do you think there's still a lot of gold to be mined, or is the rush over?
I think, right now we're still going through the app boom, so to speak. There's still a lot of companies forming around selling applications, developing really interesting applications. And I think there are a few more years left until we see this bubble burst. The question is, when is that going to happen? I'm just making a prediction based on how any technology bubble eventually bursts, you know. The question is, how are they going to keep this a very viable business? It's something that I would like to see the application be a little bit more interesting eventually, because right now it's like we have so many. Eventually, how many more are we going to need? There are like 400,000.
Well, hasn't Apple to some degree extended this by developing the iPad?
The iPad, yeah, I mean, that's a good point, right? It's like another, it's another new frontier for people to create applications.
And you have the feeling that they're thinking of something else right now, although I can't imagine what it is.
It's always difficult to predict, you know, what exactly they're going to come up with next. I mean, sometimes I question if the iPad and the tablet is just a stopgap for flexible displays that you can just roll up and put in your pocket and carry with you everywhere.
Well, is the iPad all that different from the iPhone in terms of anything, anywhere, anytime? It's like a larger iPhone without a phone capability.
I think it's like a sequel, but it's a separate revolution because people are finding different ways to use the iPad and fit it into their lives and their businesses. And we're just starting to see those applications. I mean, that's a good point. The iPad does open new opportunities for more applications to be made and capitalized on. So, you know, like doctors turning the iPad into a new X-ray chart, an interactive X-ray chart, or teachers using the iPad to teach in the classroom. It's really interesting seeing what people are doing with it.
Well, how is that all that different from just using a laptop like the Air, which is teeny? It's not all that much
bigger than
an iPad.
I think there's a lot to be said about the intimacy of touching a device. Like when I was talking to a teacher who was using the iPad in the classroom, you know, each group of students had iPads. They would say, like, they'd be working together on a project and say, "Hey, check this out." And like they'd bring the tablet over and like, you know, like zoom in on the thing and tap around on it. Like, yeah, I'm coming up with this idea and this solution. Whereas with a computer, it's like it's a little bit heavier. You can't really touch it. It's not as like visual, so to speak. Not as easy to see as like a tablet that you put on the table. So I think that's subtle, but it's pretty significant at the same time.
Now, all of these developments have had their critics, including people who are involved in the development of the internet, like Jared Lanier, and you also write about Nicholas Carr.
Sure, Nicholas Carr is famous and notorious for the headline, "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" And also, is the internet making us dumb or shallow or something like that? And he makes some pretty strong arguments that you know, constant web browsing is making us more shallow individuals than ever before. But I challenge these claims, and I also look at studies. I looked at just as many studies as he did, I'm sure. And I found that a lot of his methodology was taking an idea, like a hunch, and just reverse engineering it by just sort of like bundling together all these studies that were unrelated and trying to draw a conclusion with them. Like, say, you know, like take a rat study about like, you know, how long rats need to rest before they can learn something, and then tying that with like a multitasking study, and then concluding that, you know, like because we're multitasking 24/7, we're not resting and we're not remembering. And it's just, we can't really do that, you know. It's something that, actually, that wasn't Nicholas Carr, that was an NY Times report, but it's an example of like what people are doing with technology cynicism.
Well, if you look back in history, you see that people warned about the dangers of books. They warned about the dangers of telephones
and
radios.
Socrates even warned about the danger of the pen. So, you know, when the pen was new, he thought that people were not going to be able to memorize anymore because we're writing everything down. And it just turned out, like later on, more modern studies show that when you write something down, it actually helps ingrain the memory into your head. So I think, you know, it's a social reflex. Like, any new technology creates some sort of anxiety. But something I wrote in an editorial recently for CNN that came out yesterday, actually, was that I wish that people would stop playing the victim to new technologies. You know, it's a really pessimistic attitude toward technology. And I look at the iPhone as like, you know, I use the iPhone for a lot of things, like for, you know, getting my way around New York this week because I'm not from here, or for, you know, communicating with my coworkers and getting on Twitter and so forth. I use it to benefit myself, but I prune out all the things that are bad about it. Like, you know, when I'm with my friends, I turn the iPhone on airplane mode so I can't get any phone calls and I can't get any emails and I'm just with my friends, you know? Like, I'll take control of the technology so I can really benefit from it.
Although there are those annoying people who are in the theater and checking out their email in the middle of Act 2, which drives me crazy.
Yeah, and that's their choice, right?
No, that's a very annoying thing that they do.
I think it's annoying.
Just one more thing. I kind of alluded to this earlier. Isn't Apple kind of caught up in a bind? They have to come up with something new every so often?
I think Apple is always thinking 3 to 5 steps ahead, and I don't think it's really a challenge for them. Their goal is to use software to sell hardware, and they're going to keep thinking forward like that. So it's exciting to see what they're doing.
And I suspect you have friends there.
Oh, yeah, I have plenty of
friends
there.
So what do you think is coming next?
Just in the near future, of course, we're going to be seeing the iPhone 5 probably in October.
Will that be all that different other than they'll have a better camera?
Supposedly a faster processor. There's always an extra goodie that nobody really knows about that really just surprises people. So I think we have some interesting things to look forward to.
Jerry from New York asks, can a Wi-Fi signal be hacked as easily as a phone signal?
I think it depends on the security protocols. I think a lot of Wi-Fi networks have been improved, but everything is vulnerable. And I would assume that cell phone signals are a little bit easier. I haven't really looked into that too much, though.
Brian X. Chen, his book Always On, How the iPhone Unlocked the Anything, Anytime, Anywhere Future and Locked Us In, published by DiCapo. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much, Leonard.